A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
It's a pleasure to welcome John Kennard to our Rally Sport Magazine Dust Trails podcast. John, how are you today?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
And congratulations on your sixth New Zealand Rally Championship title, which you've just secured.
Yeah, thank you. I managed to get it at Daybreaker a few weeks ago. Hayden, one of the co-drivers, stepped out for one event, so it allowed me to be equal with Hayden for a couple of weeks until the weekend.
It must have been a nice accolade to get on your resume.
Yeah. I mean, it's always good to win any championship, and this season it's now three, so we've had a fairly good season.
Absolutely. So where do we find you today? You're in New Zealand, obviously.
Yeah, I'm at home in the vineyard. I just jumped out of the vineyard because the weather's kind of calmed down a wee bit. We've had a fairly windy spring, so makes it hard in the vineyard for spraying and doing things. So I've just been out doing vineyard things this morning.
Yeah, good. And probably nice to spend an hour or so talking about rallying again.
Yeah. Out in the vineyard by yourself in a tractor, it's all about thinking time, not talking time. So, yeah, it's good to have a chat.
Absolutely. Let's jump back to the start, John. I mean, obviously, are you a bit of a rallying nerd with your history and you've got a good memory on this sort of stuff?
Yeah, reasonable memory. It's kind of bits and pieces, obviously, that as you get a bit older, they tend to fade away.
Yeah. You started probably like the McRae brothers on motorbikes and had some injuries and had to move away from that.
Yeah, my father was involved in motorbikes from like really early on. So I got kind of dragged out to motocross meetings and things. And we had a friend who was the ACU steward, the local autocycle union steward, because it was separate from Motorsport New Zealand. So you got to go to Speedway and kind of stand out in the middle while people like Ronnie Moore and Barry Briggs and those sort of characters were racing. So that kind of got me into it in the very beginning. And then, yeah, I had a little play around with riding a bike and hurt my knees a couple of times and went, oh, that's not much fun. So then my father was also involved in navigational trialing, what we call just trialing here. We're finding your way around the countryside in the dark.
Yeah.
And he took me out front middle of a bench seat in a holding ute. And went out a few times doing that and found I really enjoyed it. So kind of that got me hooked on the four-wheel side of things.
Yeah. And your first rally car was the mighty Datsun 1200.
Yeah, it was indeed. It had a few owners when I got it, but it was a good way to learn. I still very much in favour of learning in a little car that hasn't got much power, and you kind of learn to drive the door handles off it, and that gives you a good grounding. And I kind of realised reasonably quickly that I didn't have either the money or the talent to push that side of things.
Yeah, and you soon moved into a Toyota Corolla, so that was, I guess, a little bit more up in power and performance than the Datsun.
No, it was still a 1300 one, so it was still kind of twin carb, normally aspirated 1300, so not too much difference between the two cars. So I had to handle it a wee bit better than the four-door Datsun.
So the early part of the career was driving, but I think you mentioned to me that in 1984, at the Ashley Forest Rally Sprint, you came in contact with Brent Rostron, who probably changed the direction of your rallying career.
Yeah, it did, really. We were out in the middle of the forest. Actually, it was Main Freight Rally, the local Canterbury National round of the National Championship. We broke down out in the middle of the forest and realised that kind of the next intersection down, there was somebody else parked. So wandered down and started having a chat. And that was Brent and his then co-driver, Roger Moffat. Got chatting and kind of hit it off. Had another talk at the aftermatch and had an offer to drive a service van for him on that year's Rally New Zealand, so we kind of jumped at that.
That would have been pretty exciting for you as a young bloke with the WRC event. Surely you're servicing for Brent, who was probably down the field a little bit, but the Group B Quattros and stuff running at that time must have been exciting.
Yeah, I was just saying to Hayden on the weekend, we won the end of Harapura Road, and in exactly that rally, 1984, I remember driving past as in a service van and stopping and watching an Audi Quattro for the first time ever, and it was uphill start with Michelle driving, and she kind of wriggled her backside back into the seat and then just planted boot and took off up this hill, and I was absolutely gobsmacked how these cars went.
Yeah, it was quite incredible. At this stage of your career, I mean, you were servicing for Brent on that event. Did you have any aspirations of going further as a competitor yourself?
It was probably just a time when, you know, hadn't been married very long and kind of didn't know really what we wanted to do. Definitely wanted to go overseas at some stage. Typical New Zealand big OE sort of thing. No
real aspirations. It kind of, we'd bought and sold a car and had another car, and probably if we were going to make a step up, it was going to take a big chunk of money. And as I say, I realised that certainly at that stage, not long out of university, I didn't really have the funds for it.
Mm. But Brent again changed the career path by offering you not so much a seat initially, but a trip overseas.
Yeah, they'd been overseas, I think in 1982. And Brent was already rallying. He'd been rallying basically from day dot in New Zealand rally terms. And he went away to Europe, hired a load of Sunbeam out of the UK, and he did Thousand Lakes Rally in it, in Uvascular, kind of the place to be if you were into rallying. And unfortunately, the car wasn't that great and let him down. So he came home from that trip determined that he was going to go back and do the job properly. And he thought to do the job properly, he really had to take a car from New Zealand. So after the 1984 event, then he sold the, it was only Toyota Starlet that he was in at that stage. From memory, 84, he won the 1300 class in Rally New Zealand, I think. And in 85, he was going away. Post-match function for Rally New Zealand, we got back to chatting again, and he said, well, you know, why don't you come with us? And same sort of thing, just drive the service van for us. And
yeah,
that was going to be my first time ever out of New Zealand, so we kind of jumped at that.
And that led on to competing a couple of events down the track.
Yeah, it was a really strange set of circumstances because we were essentially, the trip was a holiday and we were doing a few rallies on the side. So you'd go and do a rally and then have a few weeks holiday, and that was the way things were supposed to go. And I think we did the Hessen rally in Germany, was the first one, basically just after we'd arrived, and met a few people there, including a young German guy who was driving a front-wheel drive Escort of the time. We then ended up leaving all of the kit we had, which was basically a knackered old Wire Ridge Transit that we'd bought in the UK. and a few parts kind of scattered around the bottom of it. And then the next rally we did was in Milada Boleslav. It was Skoda Rally. So we went and had a holiday for a while, went into Czech, and then when we came out of Czech after that rally, we just kind of headed up the border through Denmark, Sweden, and into Finland. And we then had a window of just a little bit over a month, which was intended to be holiday time and recce time, because recce was completely unlimited, so you could kind of just recce whenever you wanted to.
Yeah, so the offer for you to co-drive obviously came after the navigator that Brent had at the time was having some car sickness issues?
Yeah, he was kind of getting really wound up. I mean, international rallies and kind of that sort of side of things was putting a bit of pressure on, and he was getting quite wound up and getting really serious migraines that just kind of destroyed him on the rallies. And by the time we got to Finland, he decided that there was really no way he could carry on, certainly not going from a smaller international event to a proper major WRC event. So he decided that he was going to depart and head for home. So kind of Brent didn't spend a huge amount of time looking around for another co-driver. He just kind of looked at me and said, "Oh, well, you've had a bit of experience doing this, haven't you?" Which in reality I hadn't had that much because I'd only been driving. And he said, "You might as well have a go at this if you want to."
And you're literally Johnny on the spot?
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of one of those things. It was a bit like going from high school rugby straight into an All Blacks test match, but it was certainly an opportunity you weren't going to turn down.
Oh, absolutely. And again, in 1985, the height of the Group B era, which must have been amazing from the whole experience.
Yeah, well, I was really lucky because Brent then said, well, I'll have to get you in the right frame of mind. I'll let you take the car. And there was a small rally called Manta Rally, which wasn't that far away from your vascular. And he said, well, if you take the car, you can drive again because that's what you've been doing. And you can go and try doing this Manta Rally, which was, I think it was a 6-stage rally that had 3 blind stages and then 3 pace noted stages. So we went and made some notes for that. And Brent was sitting in the back seat going, no, you can never go that fast around that corner. but we did. We had a reasonable set of notes. And it was actually, I believe it was the first event that the short quattro was ever used on. It was going to be used in your vascular.
Yep.
So they took it out for a warm-up event. And so car number one for the rally was Hano in a short wheelbase quattro.
Incredible. Yeah. And your experience driving that car, I mean, I think you said you won your class.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of the blind stages were a wee bit tight, really, because you had no idea what it was like as far as crests and jumps and things went. But then when we got to the stuff that we had notes for, it wasn't quite so bad. And I was running second in class coming into the last stage, and there was a guy in a mini, Clubman, who was leading, and it turned turtle in the middle of the stage. So that left us with the stage win by pure fortune.
That's fantastic. You say your only competition as a driver in Finland came up with a win.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Heading back to Rally Finland in 85 when you co-drove for the first time, you mentioned that the pace noting or the reconnaissance went for a month. It must have been quite staggering given what you ended up doing with in the WRC in later years.
Yeah, it was the early days, and that's just what rallies were. I think it was 51 stages in the rally, most of them not hugely long. Really classic Thousand Lakes rallies that you see from the old days, big wide roads and really, really fast. Mm. And we were very fortunate. The first time Brent did the rally, he used a Finnish co-driver, and the Finnish co-driver had a few friends. And he said, I can get you some notes if you want something as the basis to start with. We kind of said, yeah, that'd be great, especially for me. And he came back with a set of photocopy paste notes, and we said, oh, who's are they? Whose notes are they? And he said, oh, Henry Toivonen's.
Oh.
So we started the rally with a set of notes from Henry Toivonen, which I've still got here in the shed somewhere.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you finished pretty well in the event too.
Not hugely high up in the class or anything, but there was an award for the highest placed overseas privateers, or non-Scandinavian privateers, because the Scandinavians, you know, they were all the rally gurus, and for anybody to come there as a privateer and finish ahead of Scandinavians was considered a really big thing. And so, yeah, we finished the first non-Scandinavian privateers, which at the time there was still prize money around, which doesn't exist today at all. But the prize money for that award was bigger than the prize money for winning the rally overall. So it still wasn't a huge amount of money, but it was enough that we actually said, well, okay, let's go home to New Zealand after we finished, park the car in the UK. And we came back to do RAC rally the same year, Rally GB.
Yeah, wow. But not such a great experience with RAC as far as results went?
No, not as far as results went. I mean, it was a fantastic experience again because by then you were into full wintertime rallying, and it got dark fairly early in the afternoons. And when one of the very last stages we did before the alternator cooked everything in the electric system, one of the last stages was just on dawn. And we came out of this stage and the car was sliding around all over the show, and Brent was kind of going, oh, we must have broken something in the suspension. And then as we drove out of the stage and kind of down the start of the road section, you realised that in the time that we'd been in the stage, it was quite a long stage, it had got frosty and icy. So we'd actually gone on to icy surfaced gravel roads in a UK forest, and that was what was wrong. There was nothing broken in the car at all.
that experience in Europe and the UK must have clearly sowed the seed to become more of a co-driver long term, because you came back and started doing some more events in New Zealand.
Yeah, I did a few at the time. My wife was came back, started co-driving for Stu Weber, who at the time had a Starlet as well. Seems to have been a fair bit of my early career was involving Starlets. When it came around to Rally New Zealand, he decided he wanted to do Rally New Zealand. But because the national rallies were still blind rallies rather than pace noted rallies, and Rally New Zealand was the only pace notes anyone was doing, it was kind of decided that it was better that I did it, because I was the experienced co-driver by then.
Yeah.
I went with Stu and made notes with him for the first time and kind of went through that learning process.
And then a couple of years later, and I wasn't aware of this until I had a look at your stats, but you got your first WRC podium at Rally New Zealand in 1988.
Yeah, that was with Malcolm Stewart. There was... Doug Parker was co-driving for him regularly at the time, and Doug was maybe either, I think he was maybe tied up with business and things and couldn't do the event, and because Doug was doing it and Mike Fletcher and Malcolm were good friends, so normally Mike would have stepped in if Doug wasn't available, but Mike was already committed to doing the event with somebody else, so therefore I know Malcolm asked, and once again, it's one of those offers you don't really turn down. It was the first time that the Group A Quattro had been used in New Zealand rather than the Group B car.
Yep, yeah. And was that your first time in a front-running four-wheel drive car?
Yes, for sure. It was quite a big step up. In those days, when you compare it to kind of cars nowadays, just stepping into a Group A car wasn't hugely different, but it was a bigger car, and everything about it was a big step up.
And it's obviously a result that built your confidence going forward as well.
I was liking what I was doing from a co-driver point of view. Only thing I didn't like was the usual co-driver thing, where I've never been particularly good in a boat, and it meant that with your head down in the car, it wasn't that great. But drugs tend to help you along with those sort of things. So, I was really, really enjoying that side of rallying, and kind of realised that it was maybe a nice fit for me, because I didn't have the talent to go that far as a driver, but realised that maybe by linking up with some drivers and doing a good job that you could actually extend your career.
Was that motion sickness that you talked about, is that something that was short term, or was it long term in your career?
No, long term in my career. It took till I think it was 2016 Rally GB was the first time I ever started a rally without actually taking something. And that was, I'd been in, when it got to the point where we were doing rallies really regularly, I realised that I could do recce without taking something.
Yeah.
So, and in reality, on recce, you got your head down more than you have probably on the rally. So I started to try and convince myself. The trouble is, when you get in the car and it's not recce, it's the event, and you put a helmet on and balaclava and things, and you start to get hot, that just kind of exacerbates the feeling of, maybe I'm not going to be able to do this. But I finally built up the courage at Rally GB just to go, no, I'm going to try this. And in hindsight, I think when you do rallies regularly like that, your body actually compensates.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't take anything now, but I get in a car and you kind of feel your mouth goes dry and your mind kind of says, you're going to do this, so I have to adjust all your settings to this. And it almost does the job for you.
That's quite amazing, isn't it? That do you think it was an emotional or an anxiety type thing, or was it sort of something a bit more deep seated than that?
Part of it, I think, was just having too much time to think.
Yeah,
and when you're going a bit slower, and you have time to think, I'm starting to feel sick, then it just becomes a great big snowball.
Yep.
And it bowls you over eventually. But having said that, the first time that I was ever sick in a car at any sort of motorsport level was this year. So it took me a while. Hayden's having a good laugh. It took him 18 years to make me sick, but he eventually did.
And what was that? What was that event?
It was test in Canary Islands on a really twisty piece of tarmac road where there was a massive amount of G forces. And we'd actually finished the test, did the last run, and we got to the finish line of it. And I thought, if he drives away down the road now, I'll be fine. But I don't feel very well.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he stopped at the finish line of the test road to talk to a couple of the engineers. So I was sick for the first time.
Is motion sickness something that's unique to you as a co-driver, or do you know other top-line co-drivers who have suffered similar things?
Yeah, no, there's other co-drivers around who you talk to, and you quite regularly find on chats and things, people asking what's the best thing to be taking. You just have to be careful of all the, as you get up in the ranks of events, be careful of all the WADA rules and that sort of side of things. But in general, latterly, the hardest thing with it is the drowsiness side of things. That quite often those sort of drugs tend to make you drowsy. So you get an event that's fairly tough work anyway, and then you add some drugs onto it. But lately I've been using some, I used to use the famous Paihia bombs in New Zealand, but the pharmacy in Paihia stopped doing those. They were a fishing type thing for people that were deep sea big game fishing. And they were really, really good, but they involved taking an antihistamine and a caffeine based product so you didn't get drowsy.
And as you say, because the days are so long as a co-driver with writing notes and then rewriting notes and then watching onboards and stuff like that, it must really wear the body down if you are taking stuff.
Yeah, it does for sure. Yep. And especially now with videos, where you're sitting trying to watch videos at 10 o'clock at night, having done a 12-hour day of recce anyway.
Yeah.
That's really hard work. And reading and listening to notes like that is actually quite a monotonous thing. When it's not in the car and things aren't bouncing around and what have, if you're doing it to a video, so that just adds to the feeling that you're going to nod off to sleep. And when you get a bit older, it doesn't help either.
We're stepping around a bit, but is the recce something you still enjoy, or does it get a monotonous type situation where you just wish it was over?
Yeah, it's about the least enjoyable part of the rally.
Yeah.
For me, it's just, it does tend to be monotonous. It's not quite so bad if you're maybe on an event where you've got some of the notes and other ones you're writing new. But when it's just either you've got virtually all the notes, we have a system where if we've got any notes, and we only tend to go back probably 3 years is about as far as we'll go back on notes, because despite the fact that Aidan and I have been doing this for 18 years, we still change things just tiny. Well, he does, I don't. Very, very slightly each season. So you tend to find that if you go back too far in the notes, there's too much of a change. Part of that's been that the notes have tended to be gear related. And as you go from 5-speed to 6-speed, then your numbering changes slightly. So, and it's really, really hard work. If you get in the car and I'm trying to read him notes and he's changing every second note, it just becomes impossible. You end up talking over the top of one another all the time, and you kind of get to the end of the stage and go, no, this doesn't work. Throw the notes in the back seat and just start writing them afresh.
Yeah, I can imagine. Stepping back to 1989, and you mentioned before that you had one New Zealand title more than Hayden for about a week or two, but you've actually got something up on him. You've won one more Otago rally than he has.
Yeah, I won it with Simon Davies, we started out to do a national championship season, but in the end we had a few DNFs and kind of gave it up, but not before we did Rally New Zealand. But again, we had a gearbox problem and things, but yeah, it allowed me to win Rally Otago in the early days, probably just after Hayden was born.
Probably was.
It was. Yeah.
And then you had another trip back to the UK, to Finland, and did a Thousand Lakes Rally with Chris Birkbeck in a Peugeot. Who, and from my memory, I mean, watching British Championship videos and stuff, he was quite the young star at the time.
Yeah, he was for sure, and it was the strangest kind of thing again. That I used to get the UK Motoring News magazine sent out each week, but because of the mailing side of things, it would arrive effectively in New Zealand a week after it had been published.
I don't know what you mean.
And one turned up, and on the front page there was this tiny little article about Chris was going to do the Thousand Lakes Rally, and he was really trying to find somebody who was an experienced co-driver on Thousand Lakes. So I kind of, and it just had his phone number, so I picked up the phone and rang him thinking, well, he'll say, well, I've found somebody already, don't worry about it. And he said, no, I haven't found anybody, and I really like the fact that you've done it before, and would you come over? So that was another one of those opportunities that you just kind of right place, right time, put your hat in the ring, and it happened. And unfortunately, it was one of the early times where after the Group B era, when things were really, really fast, they started trying to slow the rally down by turning off the main roads and going into quite small, quite often quite rough roads. So the average speed for the stage went down.
Yeah.
And I think that year was locally known as the Rally of 1,000 Farmyards, because you were perpetually turning off the big proper gravel roads into a farmyard to come back out of it again. And in the end, we broke either one of the engine mounts, and it ripped the leads out of the oil cooler, the hoses of the oil cooler.
Okay.
So that was kind of the end of that.
Yeah, and it was only the one event with Chris?
Yes, yeah, it was just a kind of fill-in thing. And at that stage, he had a regular co-driver in the UK, and I didn't have the intention of kind of staying over there, so it was going to make it hard if you're having to go backwards and forwards.
For sure, yeah. Shortly after that, though, your career sort of changed directions totally, and you went more into an organisation role. Tell me about that initially.
I had been doing bits and pieces. I'd been a member of the club committee, as you know, you usually are at some stage during a career.
Yeah.
And I'd been clerk, of course, and organiser for the same main freight rally, the same Canterbury rally. I lived in Christchurch, and I'd run the Canterbury rally once, and there was a group of people who, including Brent and the Fletchers and some of those sort of people, who'd been right in the beginning in rallying, and it was going to be the 21st anniversary. So they decided that if they could put a committee together to run a rally, that we should run a good old-fashioned Rally New Zealand, Two Island type international rally.
Yep.
And call it the 21st anniversary Silver Fern Rally. And the trouble then was that the powers that be decided that, in actual fact, it wasn't the 21st anniversary, because it was only the 20th time the rally would have been run, because during the fuel crisis, it hadn't been run for a year. So there became this great debate about whether it was the 21st anniversary event or not. It was the 21st anniversary. The fact that it hadn't been run 21 times didn't make any difference. So we went ahead with it and got Shell on board as a sponsor, because they'd been fairly heavily involved in rallying in the early days in New Zealand, and ran an event that started in Christchurch, did a complete loop around the South Island, eventually crossed over to the North Island, went from Wellington up through a good chunk of the North Island to finish in Rotorua.
That's a big event.
Yeah, it was. It was a full 7-day event. It was like at the time, you know, the Motor Guard rallies and those sorts of things, the sort of format that they ran. That was what we were trying to replicate. And I didn't have a huge field, but it was a really, really good event using some of the classic stages. And now we've got to the point where, you know, Silver Fern Rally as such has become a biannual thing.
Absolutely. So at this time, did you still have aspirations of continuing down the co-driving route, or the organisational type stuff that you'd done there sort of planted a few more seeds to do some more stuff there?
Kind of both, really. I quite enjoyed, I was working in an architectural role, which involved quite a bit of site organisation and, and that side of things. So I quite liked organising things. So that side of it was attractive, but the co-driving was still attractive as well. So, but the combination of the two kind of convinced me that I was spending, because the architectural work I was only doing it as contracts. So, and I'd do a set of drawings for a house or something, and then I'd go, well, this lines up with going and doing a rally. So I'd have 2 or 3 weeks off, and it allowed me to kind of fill gaps like that.
Yeah.
And it just sort of convinced me that I probably should have a go at actually doing something rallying based full time.
And then that encouraged you to move to the UK?
Yeah, I was really lucky that I had the opportunity to live in the UK, to have a visa and live there. And because of the kind of contacts I'd made in the time that we'd been at these international rallies and going back and meeting Chris Burbeck and that sort of side of things and others that I'd met along the way, then the UK was the obvious place to go and try and do something. So, yeah, and I think October 1990, I shifted to the UK.
And then got involved with a company, Coward Sport, which is quite quite well known even in this part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, they were the rally art dealer in the UK. It was kind of the early days of rally art that Peter Collins sort of picked up the rally art franchise. And I mean, I spent a year and a half probably working up to the point where I could actually get into a role, because it was just a case of knowing people. So I was doing events, and I did a wide end rally at one stage in the Peugeot Challenge class with a driver called Steve Eggleston.
Yeah,
and when those events were done all on maps, which is something I'd had no exposure to whatsoever. I love maps. I still, really love sitting down with a map and looking at all the detail on it. So I said to Steve that I hadn't really done anything on maps at all, and he said, "Oh, well, we can give it a go and see how it goes." And I think he got a bit frustrated during the rally that my ability wasn't that of somebody who'd been doing, most of their guys that were really good on maps came out of the Motoring News open road rallying that they did at the time. And he was a wee bit frustrated when we got to the end, and we finished third in the class. And we were 45 seconds behind the guy who won it, and it was a guy called Richard Burns with a co-driver called Robert Reed.
Yeah, never heard of him, no.
And the guy that was second was, I think, about 17 seconds in front of us, and it was a guy called Steve Bennett, but he had a co-driver called Michael Park. So kind of over the course of that event, you got to meet three people who were later on in your career were quite well-known names. And it was those sort of contacts that it took to get in to somewhere.
Yep.
But I also met a co-driver called Andy Moss, who at the time was in the role of coordinator at Coward Sport, doing the team logistics side of things. And he was just about to leave the role to go to ProDrive as their team coordinator. And he suggested to Peter that I was probably a good fit to do it. So that was kind of the job came along. Again, it's just, I think all the way through your career, you look at it and you go, it's kind of sort of right place, right time, chuck your hat in the ring, and see what happens. And I was really lucky with that, because as well as the Mitsubishi stuff in the UK and whatever they were running in Europe, they were running Shinazuka's, Kenjiro's World Championship program, which was mainly focused on endurance events, Safari Rally, Ivory Coast, but also involved, he'd choose some of the rallies that he liked. New Zealand, he was quite regularly out here, just because he liked the rally. And so, yeah, that gave me a lead into doing WRC work.
You must have done a good job at very quickly too, because it wasn't too long before you ended up at ProDrive.
Yeah. No, I mean, the first parts of the quad sport role were just straight in at the deep end. The first thing I ever did was safari rally, and I mean, that was open road rallying safari where you had 100, 150, 170, 180 kilometer long sections where you service two or three places through the section. And all the logistics of that had to be worked out. So it was a big, big job. But yeah, I worked with Kenjiro. They liked what I did. We all got on really, really well. But then Andy Moss got in touch again in 1995. Because in 1996, Safari was due to come back into the World Championship, but it ran a very different timing system.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody kind of had their heads fully wrapped around the way it worked. And so ProDrive kind of said, well, you know, because you've got the experience, you know people there. And at the time, I mean, George, because it was only really Toyota, and then Kenjiro's Mitsubishi program that were running Safari Rally. George Donalds and I were the only two people that were actually involved in Safari Rally. So when George was tied up with Toyota, so I was the one that got shoulder tapped, and kind of Andy said, well, you know what you're doing. Why don't you come and do Safari Rally for us? And kind of. And then as a side to that, he then and one more event down the track said, oh, and by the way, I'm leaving at the end of the year from my role at ProDrive. So once again, it was a case of, well, if you want to meet David Richards and David Lapworth, and if everybody agrees, John Spiller was the team manager at the time, then maybe that's a role you can step into, and I did. So
We'll get to that just in a moment, but before that time, back in 93, you were still doing some co-driving, even doing the European Championship.
Yeah, bits and pieces is kind of, again, just kind of keeping myself out there. But there was a driver, Hideaki Miyoshi, Japanese driver, who was also a coordinator and a photojournalist, of all things.
Yeah.
And he was the other half of the logistics for Shinazuka's program. So I worked alongside him for all those years. And Andy Moss had been co-driving for him as well. and when Andy stepped out of that role, I stepped into it. And we did a few events at a VR4. He had a Group A VR4 that was based in the UK. Actually, the year before I did anything with him, I think he did the full UK championship with Andy and ran quite well in it. But then when the Lancer first came out, he decided, well, yeah, let's have a go in the Group N European Championship, which had just been created. There was no Group N Championship until that kind of when the Lancer appeared and the Subaru as well. So we went and did that and got a really limited budget in a Evo 2 Lancer.
Yep.
And we had some not too bad results, but we had one DNF in the middle of it, and because of the budget we had, we couldn't afford to do another event. It was in the days when you had a coefficient system for European Championships. So
that's right,
And a coefficient 10, I think it started at maybe 20, 10, 5, and 2.
Yep.
And according to what the coefficient was. So we chose the events that had higher coefficients. So we did Ypres, we did Poland, Rally Poland. Rally Germany, Deutschland, as it was called. And it's amazing, you go back to some of those places now and people come up to you with photographs of Miyoshi and myself on stages, especially in Germany for some reason, and get you to sign a photo from when you were here for the very first time.
Wow.
But in the end, we're quite unlucky. I think we only lost the Group N Championship by a point, and that was only because we didn't have the budget to go to the last rally.
That's pretty tight then, isn't it?
It was good fun.
Yeah. So moving back to 1995 and late in the season, so suddenly your team coordinator for ProDrive and the Subaru World Rally Team, it must have been almost a pinch yourself moment.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You could never ever believe that you'd kind of just 5 years earlier chucked everything in New Zealand and gone, oh, shift to the UK and try and find a job going rallying and to get within 5 years to get to that point was just astounding, really.
And that first event you worked for the team was, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the 95 Catalunya Rally, which is perhaps one of the most famous events that Subaru had done. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, the rest of the team, because it ran very, very close to Hong Kong Beijing in those days, because Subaru and Mitsubishi were both very strong in Asia Pacific, then they both did Hong Kong Beijing. And so the team was essentially away, and I just got everything again, dropped on the plate and just said, hey, I'll sort out Spain while we're all in China. And so I did the job, and kind of everything was going to plan until we got to that infamous moment where Colin and Carlos had been in agreement the night before. That on the last day of the rally, because the two of them were running first and second, then whoever was leading at the end of the day was going to be allowed to be the winner, and it was Carlos. And Colin was told that you finished second behind Carlos, which didn't go down very well. It's all fairly historic now, but there's pieces of video, which I saw a piece of it again the other day, of these three guys leaping out in the middle of the road to try and stop Colin. So, because he just pushed on and he was leading the rally within a few stages. And I think at that moment, there were the three of us on the road. It was John Spiller, Nigel Riddle, and myself. And Bill's, he disappeared fairly quickly. He didn't stay out in the middle of the road very long. And I heard Colin change up a gear and thought, nah, he's not going to stop. And I dived off the road. Nigel stayed there right until the last minute before he dived off. But and I still, somewhere out again in the shed amongst the files, there's a full broadsheet Spanish newspaper from the following day. And across the top of the pages, right across the whole broadsheet size of it, is a series of framed photos of us appearing out into the middle of the road, three of us, two of us, one of us, and Colin not stopping. And that was how incensed the Spanish were that one of their major daily newspapers ran it right across the top of the page.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, there was some amazing video footage of it at the time, and it must have been an incredibly volatile service area when the car came back.
Yeah, before that, because we'd parked on the side of a piece of motorway and climbed down to where the stage was, which ran underneath the motorway, we climbed back up to the car that was parked on the side of the road, and it had knife cuts in two out of four tyres. So they were fairly incensed before we ever got back as far as the service
car. So this is on the service car, you got the cut tyres?
Yeah, on the Subaru station wagon that we were driving at the time. We had to get somebody to bring us out a wheel before we could actually get to service.
Was that that reaction from Colin at the time? Obviously, it all revolved around him wanting to win the world championship at the last event in the UK. Was that typical of his? Was he a volatile person within the team, or was it just a separate situation?
No, he tended to be quite a volatile sort of character. I guess he stayed fairly mellow, but when something did set him off, he'd kind of be very much like that, kicking things around and kind of just typical Colin. There's that personality that kind of seems to come out in characters who do really well at things. They can be quite volatile at times.
Yeah. And at your time at Subaru, you had, as you mentioned, a couple more really interesting episodes, one with Kenneth Erickson in Argentina, I think.
Argentina, yeah.
Yeah, and I watched some video of that. So explain to the listeners what happened there.
It was a really strange situation where there was a stage that was being used that it was a regular stage on their national rallies. It was often used a couple of times a year on national rallies, but for the international version, they changed the format of the stage. So instead of going off coming to a junction, turning right, going around a bit of a loop to rejoin back onto the same piece of stage, a bit like the turning off into the slower bits of road. Yeah. In Finland. Instead of that, they just went straight through. But the marshals that were on the stage were marshals who regularly set up the stage. So they were there thinking, assumed that the stage would turn to the right and disappear around the loop and rejoin again. So Kenneth was first on the road. When he arrived there, the road was barricaded with bits of log and things, so you couldn't actually go straight ahead. But he had a look at it and went, well, the stage goes straight ahead and that's where I'm going. And he drove over the logs to go the correct way down the stage. But behind him, the others all turned to the right and headed out across the fields and came back round again, which would have been good for Kenneth because it was shorter the way that he went. But unfortunately, in driving over the things that were being used to close the road, he got a puncture that he had to stop and fix. So we got to the end of the stage and the lead of the rally had changed. But in reality, most of the front end of the field hadn't followed the route in the road book. So we went through the whole normal stewards process of kind of dealing with those sorts of things. And in the end, it was decided that because the others didn't get an advantage, then the results would stand. But in actual fact, that then penalised Kenneth and he dropped from first to third, I think, in the end.
Yeah, pretty amazing. The fact that the bloke who did the right thing got the penalised the most.
I guess it's one of those things where if you stand and shout enough, it probably gets some sort of attention. But it was just a steward's decision, and your ability then to protest those sort of things is pretty difficult.
Yeah, and then another situation with Colin McRae in Italy when he actually lost his licence.
Yeah, that was kind of another one of those eye-opening things. Actually, it was the thing that ended up kind of introducing me to Fabrizio Pons.
Yeah.
Because we spent 2.5 days basically spending all of our time trying to get Colin's license back. We had a test, a shakedown type test, before the rally, and he drove himself up to that. And in Italy, they have speed limits that change when you go into a tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was San Remo and you were going up into the mountains, there was a series of tunnels. And, of course, Colin being Colin just made no attempt to slow down whatsoever. And at the end of one of these tunnels was police with a radar gun. And they stopped him at a speed which wasn't that much over the speed limit if it had been just the normal piece of road. But because it was the tunnel, he ended up losing his license because it was more than 30K over the speed limit. And it was quite some process we ended up going through to get it back again. It was difficult to find an advocate who would actually take on the case because it was going to be a really high-profile case and one that most of them thought they'd lose. But we've eventually found a young woman who was kind of a really go-getter type advocate lawyer, and she agreed to take it on, but she was away on holiday up in the mountains with a family. So in the middle of the night, Fabrizio and I had to go up there, and the first thing that happens, being an Italian family, there's a great big jug of red wine gets pulled out onto the table, and Fabrizio's allergic to alcohol.
Oh, is he?
So I think Fabrizio ended up driving back to the hotel that night because we sat there for a long, long time trying to convince this woman to take the case.
And he ended up doing the rally.
Yeah, I handed his driver's license through the fence at Parc Fermé at the start to Nicky because they weren't going to let him out of Parc Fermé until he had his license in his hand. And he had the license in his hand when he drove out the gate, and he won the rally.
Quite amazing. You stayed at ProDrive until what, the end of 2000, was that right?
After Safari 2000, I swapped over and started doing some work with the customer team at kind of the over and over and over again type nature of, every 3 weeks doing a WRC rally was just starting to get a bit tiresome.
Yeah.
So I swapped over to the customer side of things. So you had new people to work with and kind of different events because you'd do some national events. I did quite a bit with Frederick Dorr, who was just paying to have that plain white World Rally car that he had. And doing like French Championship and things, as well as some WRC events.
Mm. And then a couple of years later on, you ended up in the USA, which is obviously a big change again.
Yeah, from the customer side of things, I did a year as team manager for Power Horse World Rally Team out of Austria.
Yeah.
With Achim Mertl, who was kind of one of the top Austrian drivers at the time, and they were trying to get him into a full-time WRC seat. So I did some work with them, but Power Horse was trying to be Red Bull and kind of didn't succeed, so that all fell apart. And then later in that year, in 2002, Peter Collinson again got in touch and wanted to run a Mitsubishi program in the US. It was when ProDrive had been really, really strong, and they'd convinced Mitsubishi US that if they had a program and they could challenge ProDrive, then it was going to be really good advertising for them. And they were going to spend $2 million a year for 3 years to kind of learn about the championship in the first year, maybe win a few rallies in the second year, and by the third year, you know, be full on to win the championship. But in the end, it was kind of half UK, half US team, using pretty, for the time, pretty non-standard Mitsubishis.
Mm.
And Michelin tyres. I had some good contacts in Michelin, and we managed to get a 40-foot container of Michelin tyres for the season. So we were really well set up. That was the first time that they'd been run under local branding rather than Michelin branding. And we ended up winning the championship, the Drivers' Championship, the Co-Drivers' Championship, the Manufacturers' Championship, finishing second in all of them as well. It was a really sad year, because it was the year that Mark Lovell and Roger Freeman got killed on one of the events there, which I found really hard at the time, because certainly Roger was a good friend. And that kind of coloured the way the year went. But we won everything, and at the end of it, Mitsubishi went, "Thank you very much. We've achieved everything we wanted to achieve. We won't do the next 2 years."
And they saved themselves $4 million.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that was with David Higgins driving too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was David and Daniel Barrett, who then I spent a lot of time with after that as his co-driver. So,
And that was the only spent doing stuff in the US?
Yeah, because the program just ended then, and I kind of had a look. And by that stage, I'd bought myself a tiny little 2-hectare vineyard in New Zealand, actually in 2002. And I kind of went, I don't know much about this vineyard thing. You know, somebody will manage it, and we'll grow grapes and sell them, and that'll be the end of it.
Yeah.
And we decided to come down to New Zealand for Christmas and see what the vineyard was all about, because it was summertime in New Zealand and it was going to be nicer than being in the Northern Hemisphere. And we're still here. It's kind of from 2003, it became, you know, let's stay there and do some work on the vineyard, and we've developed things from there, really.
Been pretty successful then.
Yeah, it was kind of, we have our own label, Vicarage Lane Wines, and kind of export wines back to Finland. My wife's a Finn. It goes quite well.
Mm.
And it gives us the ability to be in Europe in the summertime, or the European summertime, which is quite a handy thing when it comes to rallying.
Absolutely. Were you still co-driving at this time, John? I mean, this is 2003, 2004-ish.
I'd done very little. I did kind of playing around with one of the guys from ProDrive, and we'd gone to a few French national rallies, but it was all kind of just for fun. And because of the amount of time I'd spent doing the WRC stuff at ProDrive, there was no way that you were doing much in the way of co-driving in between those events. Every 3 weeks, and kind of it took 10 days by the time you got there, did the event, and go home again.